Go to 2 Kings chapter 5. If you have your Bibles with you, 2 Kings chapter 5, and I'll meet you there. We're all very familiar, I imagine, with the story of Naaman. At the beginning of the chapter, you see this man, and he is, for all accounts, he's an upstanding man. He's got a good reputation. He's got a lot going for him. He's the captain of the Syrian army, working for the very king of Syria. He's a man of high reputation, of high prestige. But, as you recall, he had an incurable disease, leprosy. And the symbolism there is as it represents sin. And remember, on one of their raids, they brought in a maid of Israel. And she had heard about this prophet, Elisha. And she tells her master, and they go through the king as the story continues, and they send information to the Israelite king, and they basically, as time progresses, he ends up having this conversation with Elisha. And you remember at first, he just wanted Elisha, just hold your hand over the place and pray, and let's be done with this. But Elisha has very specific instructions from God. You've got to go dip in the River Jordan 7 times if you want to be cleansed. And he argues with him some more. And well, what about this river? What about that river? Why does it have to be the Jordan River, right? We have plenty of rivers that we could choose from. But finally, Naaman does it. He goes, he dips 7 times, and he's cleansed of his leprosy. Do you know what happened after that? Normally, we kind of end there, and there's some great lessons from that, and we've done a study on that before. But what happens next is also very significant. In fact, some might be surprised to know that Naaman's leprosy didn't just dissipate. It did for a moment. God took it away. But his leprosy ended up being passed on to someone else. And that man is who I want to talk about this morning. His name is Gehazi. Gehazi. You see, after this took place, Naaman comes back to Elisha, and he wants to give Elisha some money, if you will. He wants to give him some payment, a blessing. If you're in 2 Kings 5, let's pick up here in about verse 15. Verse 15, he returned to the man of God, to Elisha. He and all his company, and came and stood before him and said, "Behold now, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel." What a statement. "Now therefore I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant." Elisha, I want to give you some payment for what you did. Right? And you remember back earlier the amount that he brought with him. Sure, he gave probably some to the king, but he was a wealthy man. Verse 16, but he said, "As the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none." He urged him to take it, but he refused. All right, a conversation ensues. Now jump down to verse 20. This is where our lesson really picks up. Verse 20. Right, Naaman leaves, and Elisha takes nothing. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, there's that but, that contrast. "The man of God said, Behold, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian, in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him." Elisha turned down this reward, but I'd like to have some of this for myself. So verse 21, Gehazi followed after Naaman. "And when Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him and said," notice this question, "is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master has sent me, saying, Behold, even now there be come to me." Notice this story he fabricates. My master is telling me that there be coming some from Ephraim, 2 young men, of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and 2 changes of garments. Right? A modest request. Verse 23, and Naaman said, "Be content. Take 2 talents. I mean, he's really being a good man here. Naaman's really being taken advantage of. He says, "Take 2 talents, not just one." He urged him, and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags, 2 changes of garments, and laid them upon 2 of his servants, and they bare them before him. And when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand, and bestowed them in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master. All right, so Gehazi is coming before Elisha now, after this is done. And Elisha says to him, "Whence comest thou, Gehazi? Where are you coming from?" And he said, "Thy servant went nowhither." I didn't go anywhere. I've been here the whole time, Elisha. What are you talking about? Verse 26, and he said unto him, "Went not my heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee?" How Gehazi thought that Elisha could not somehow know this and figure this out, being a man of God and being a prophet. I don't know. But he tries to trick him, and Elisha says, "Don't you know that I went with you in heart? Is it a time to receive money, to receive garments and oliveyards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants?" Then verse 27. "The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever." And he went out from his presence a leper as white as snow. How unfortunate. To him, to his seed forever, they were going to have this leprosy because of this decision. There are three lessons, three applications I want to pull from this to make note of. I want you to think about this man Gehazi and what he did. First of all, we can learn from Gehazi, and there's a number of lessons we could pull out, but here's the first one I chose. Don't make sacred things common, right? Gehazi took something that was a blessing, a miracle, something that God had given Elisha the ability to do, and he took advantage of this. He made it as just it was a normal thing. Could you imagine? I want you to think about for a minute that you were Gehazi. What would you do if you were there right now and you witnessed Elisha perform this miracle? And many of the miracles that Elisha had already performed and would perform. Knowing who he was, knowing that his power was real, that God was definitely real, that God was working through Elisha, wouldn't we be in awe of that? We would be amazed. But how could Gehazi just make this such a common thing, and so much that he's willing to just be greedy and go take advantage of what had just happened? I would submit that it's because in time, when we see something, when we experience something over and over and over again, sometimes we begin to make it not such a big deal. It's not so sacred anymore. It's just more of a common thing. And so maybe Gehazi got kind of just bored with this. It wasn't a big deal to him anymore. It wasn't important, right? We might do this with some things too, such as worship. John 4:24, you know the verse, "God is a spirit. They that worship him must do so both in spirit and in truth." And in the Lord's body, we focus on that truth aspect, and rightly so. We want to get that right. We want to do it according to God's will, but we can't neglect the spirit part of that either. The attitude, the heart, going into the worship and focusing and pouring out our love and adoration, all of those things. But when we do it every Sunday morning, many of us, we come back on Sunday nights. We come back on Wednesday nights. There are other activities that we're involved with. We had gospel meetings, and maybe you go to even to a lectureship, and all of these different things that are going on. You might just make it another common thing. It's just another weekly occurrence. It's not sacred anymore. It's not holy anymore. It's just another activity, right? When we do something over and over again, we've got to be careful that we don't just bog it down. I mean, think about it. The songs, right? There are a lot of congregations, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with this, but a lot of congregations, you know, they're changing songs. They're keeping it fresh, which is great. I love that, actually. I think that's a great idea. But maybe one of the reasons that they're doing that is so that they don't just continue to always sing the same songs. Because what might happen when, let's say you have 30 songs that you always sing, I'm not saying we do that here, but just as an example, we have the song leaders are always singing the same 30 or so songs, eventually it just might not be holy anymore. We might not really think about what we're singing anymore. We might not really pay attention because we've got it memorized. It's just secondhand nature to sing that song now, right? What about the Lord's Supper? I mean, we focus on the same thing every first day of the week. We're focusing on Christ, and is that holy? Is it sacred to us, or is it just another activity that we participate in and don't really give much thought to? Right? What about this preacher? This guy's going to get here, he's going to pace back and forth again, and he's preaching from the same book, and he's got the same style every time, right? It could just become a common thing and not a big deal. What about creation, nature? When Amber and I first moved down here last year, we were talking about these palm trees. And I remember that, I don't remember if it was her or I that made this statement, but one of us said, "I don't think we're ever going to get used to these palm trees. This is great. We love seeing those palm trees." I don't know about her, but I don't notice them like I used to, like I did last year when we first got here. And I've kind of gotten, I guess, desensitized to the palm trees. And, well, again, that's a normal thing to do. You go outside, and I'm thankful, by the way. I'm thankful that our God chose to give us seasons. I think there's a reason for that. And one of those is that Every time the fall comes, it's you don't see that every day, and it's new and it's exciting and it's a beautiful time. And maybe you love the winter, maybe you love the snow. You probably don't get much of that down here, but maybe you love the spring. Whatever it is, the beauty, the blooming, and it's constantly going. But still, we can get desensitized to that and not let nature remind us that God is incredible, that He created all of these things. Right? Think about how often God used memorials, remembrances, tokens, so that the people would see these things and they would be reminded of the fact that they had God. Right? When we sin against God, ultimately what we're doing at that moment is we forget about God. Right? Who sins thinking about and focusing on God and being prayerful and studying? And when we look outside at nature, it ought to remind us of God and motivate us to stay away from that sin. But if we get desensitized to it, we don't give credit to the designer anymore, right? It's just old. I see it every day. It's not a big deal anymore. I'm not reminded of God. I'm not motivated to serve Him, right? Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare, the firmament declares the handiwork of God, right? Some new model of something comes out that's engineered brilliantly, and it's exciting, and we give credit to the designer, but we don't always give credit to the designer of this world, to the designer of us, because these special things can become so common so easily. One last thought on this is the family. I grew up an only child, as I've told you before, and I didn't have this sibling rivalry. I don't know what that's like. You see it on TV, and you hear about it. Maybe you see it with other folks' kids. I have before, but sometimes when you're around somebody a lot, even if it's your family, there's fussing and there's fighting, and you just kind of get on each other's nerves sometimes, right? It's just natural. It happens. Even as adults, you might have a family member that maybe they move in with you. Maybe they move into town, and you're spending a lot of time with them, and you just kind of sometimes argue about things. Marriages, husbands and wives, we're around each other all the time, and we start to bicker about things. Little things that shouldn't bother us begin to bother us because these things that are wonderful, we take them for granted. What a wonderful thing that I have a spouse, right? We've only been married 6 years nearly, six years. And sometimes we differ, and we'll tell ourselves, you know, we'll talk about it later. We have those times when we're like, why would we even be upset about that? That wasn't really a big deal, was it? But I can't imagine being married. Some of you have been married for 50 years. That is awesome. And I guess in 50 years, you know, we joke sometimes, and husbands say they've just learned to listen to the wife and just let her have her way. You know, we joke about stuff like that, but you've made it work. But sometimes you take those things for granted, and you bicker about things that just really don't matter. More importantly, though, and the real emphasis here, Luke 8 and verse 21, I love this passage. There's a couple of times Jesus says this in different ways, but I love this because Jesus says, who is my family? Who really is my mother? Who really are my brothers and sisters? Because they're asking Him, Jesus, aren't you concerned about your mom? Aren't you concerned about your biological family? And Jesus says, it's those that hear the word and do it. That's my family. That's not to discredit our biological families. Don't misunderstand me. But here's the point. The church is our family too. And we spend a lot of time together. And again, the church can just become another person. It just can become another group of people like our employees or anybody else that we really don't care about like we should, that we're really not there for like we should be. I'm tired of this person's always got needs. I don't want to help them out anymore. This person's always complaining about this or that. I'm just going to stay away from that person. I don't want to be there for them anymore. And right, you get the idea. Let's keep going though. Number two. Gehazi, it was a very, very selfish thing that he did. Gehazi, for him to go out and to try to take this for himself, to get some of this reward, some of this blessing, and he wasn't thinking of anybody else but himself. Sometimes we just like to think that we're the center of the universe. There's just not a better way to put it. It's like we're in a movie and we're the lead role, right? Everything is about us. The focus is always on me, 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 and we're not always selfless as we ought to be. Gehazi was certainly selfish at this time. There's this principle in the Bible. I got to thinking about this, and the best way to talk about it, to address it, to apply it. And I got to thinking about property rights. And in Exodus 20, of course, one of the very Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. And when you get to chapter 22 in verse 1, he says, if you steal, say, an oxen right? You steal somebody's ox, you've got to return that to them. If you sell it or give it away, you're going to have to give them 5 oxen to replace it. If you steal someone's sheep, you're going to have to give them 4 sheep to replace that sheep. There were rules. You don't violate property rights. You don't steal. You don't take what is someone else's. Here's the point. Gehazi had no business whatsoever in that deal, in that circumstance. He had nothing to do with that. But for some reason, he thought that he had the business, right? He had the right to go in and say, I want to have some of this. I want to participate in this. Right? Here's the application for us. We need to respect what is not our business. For example, a man is desirous of another man's wife. Right? I'm not talking about little real estate here. I'm talking about that which belongs to another. To covet another man's wife, that's a violation of this principle. Who am I to think that I can be so selfish as to have this other man's wife or to have this other woman when I'm married, right? I'm not the center of the universe. What about this one, though? 1 Timothy 5. Grab your Bibles. I'm doing a lot of talking and referencing. Let's turn to a passage or two. 1 Timothy chapter 5. Verse 13. Normally we talk about gossip, we go to Romans chapter 1, but I want to go to a different verse this time. 1 Timothy 5, verse 13. He's talking about widows in this context and younger widows and those who are unmarried. But there's a great application principle here really for all of us. He says, with all they learned to be idle, wandering about from house to house, not only idle, but tattlers also and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. We sometimes pick on ladies for this, but it's true of men and women. This has nothing to do with it. It's not gender exclusive, right? Whether you're a guy or a girl, there's a tendency to desire information. Information that we have no business getting. And I take that information that's not mine, and I may want to go out and tell somebody else. I'm basically infringing their property rights. I'm taking that knowledge that I have no business knowing or having anything to do with, and I'm giving it to someone else. I mean, after all, if it's whispered, anybody will listen to anything that's whispered, right? You've heard that saying? And we gossip. That's property infringement. You might define gossip as taking someone else's property, their information, and speaking. Ask yourself, before you're going to talk about something, ask yourself, is this mine? Is this my information to share? Do I have the rights to this property, you might say? What about this one, though? Worship, the church itself. Why is it that there's so many different ways that people worship God? Why is it that when you go and visit these various denominations, and even some of the churches of Christ, I say that loosely, but you go in and sit in the auditorium and they are jamming out to this rock band, and it's exciting, and it's fun, and it's entertaining. Why do they do that? Because it's about me, right? This application, there's so many things we could talk about, but in today's society, this is one of the things. Why is it that I'm going to have a woman who's the preacher of my congregation? Why is it that I'm going to have a deacon that's a female, an elder that's a female? Right? It's about what I want. A woman wants to have that right and ability, and so I'm just going to bend the text or ignore it altogether and give them that opportunity. Right? It's the Lord's Supper. Why am I not going to partake of it every first day of the week? Why take of it once a month or once a year? And it's just about what I want. And it's not, don't get me wrong, I know these are good people and they genuinely love God. And again, I use that term love loosely in the use that we would say of it. They care about Him and they want to do what's right. But it's a selfish worship. It's about me. Colossians, Paul calls it will worship. It's really man's own will is what it is. Jesus calls it vain worship. Matthew 15:9. When man takes his own concepts, his own ideas, and puts it in the worship service, motivated by what he wants, ultimately, what he or she wants, that is vain worship. That is this idea of, that stems from selfishness. One last thought here, and the lesson will be yours. Be careful with the phrase, all is well. And here's what I mean by that. When he asked Gehazi, when Naaman asked Gehazi, is all well? And Gehazi tells him that it is. You know, in a sense, it probably was. Things were good. He had a great life. He was very blessed to be working for Elisha. He had the freedom, obviously, that he did in this case to go out and to do this and to witness what he did, to be so close to God and witnessing the power of God. In a sense, a lot was well. But just because things are physically well doesn't mean all is well. We need to be careful about that phrase, right? Maybe things are going good at the job. Maybe health is good in your family, and that's great. Maybe your family is close and you're spending time together. You've got a stress-free life and things are wonderful. All of those things are probably not true for all of us, but let's say that they are. To say all is well when I'm not spiritually right, though, when I'm not spiritually healthy, spiritually rich, all is not well. I think one of the greatest tools, I guess I would say, of Satan, one of the most powerful things he's done in this world is giving folks peace when there really is no peace. He's convinced folks that they are at peace with God, that they're right with God, or that there is no heaven or hell, that there is no God, there's nothing to worry about. And he's gotten them to believe that everything's fine. I'm healthy. Now, don't misunderstand me. We need to be thankful for those things. Health and job and all of that's a blessing from God. But if I'm not spiritually right, then all is not well. We sing the song sometimes, "It is well with my soul." Can I really sing that? That's the real question. That's all that really matters. Is it well with my soul? That's what that phrase should really mean. Matthew 24, verse 36 and following. "Of that day knoweth no man, not even the angels, not the Son, but the Father only." And there's going to be folks, he says, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but they're going to be, just like in the days of Noah, they're going to be given in marriage. Right? They're going to marry whoever they want, many times as they want. They're going to be eating and drinking, whatever they want. They'll be at their jobs. They'll be with their families. They'll be doing whatever they do, going to the bars, partying, whatever it is, whether it's good, whether it's bad. But the Son of Man is going to come. Maybe you'll be at the workplace. Maybe you'll be here at the building. This would be a great place to go, wouldn't it? Maybe you'll be at home. Maybe you'll be asleep. I don't know. But when He comes again, that's it. Everybody's just going to be doing what they're doing, and that's it's just going to happen. And then the question really will be asked. Just like Naaman asked Gehazi, and we might think of, hypothetically, the Lord asking that question. Is all well? What are we going to be able to say? Look at Ephesians with me. One more passage I'll ask you to turn to. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. I mentioned Satan and this tool he has. And really, that's the idea Paul is getting at here. Ephesians 4 and verse 18. You know what? Actually, begin in verse 17 with me. Ephesians 4, 17. "This I say therefore," Paul writing says, "and testify in the Lord, that ye henceforth walk not as other Gentiles walk, in the vanity of their mind." Notice this. "Having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart." You ever heard the phrase, "ignorance is bliss"? I get the phrase. And physically, sometimes there may be some truth to that. But spiritually, that is not the case. Ignorance is absolutely not bliss. Ignorance is the tool of Satan. He says through ignorance that's in them, and they're blind. They can't see. Their eyes are not enlightened. Verse 19, "who being past feeling have given themselves over to lasciviousness, to work all uncleanness with greediness." Believe it or not, it is possible, and we see it all the time, for a man, for a woman to just be embedded in sin so much that they don't even feel it. There's no guilty conscience whatsoever anymore. They're blinded, they're ignorant, and they feel like all is well. But that is a false peace. 1 Timothy 4, verse 2, I've mentioned to you before. For those of you who are not here, and just by way of reminder, he talks about the searing, the conscience seared with a hot iron. You remember that? Cauterizo, the word there where we get to cauterize. You see it in the movies where they sear that skin, and what happens? The nerves are dead. You burn them, that you can't feel anymore. It's numb. Spiritually speaking, people are cauterized. They're numb, and that's what Satan wants. He wants you to feel like you're at peace. He wants you to feel like everything's fine and dandy, as we sometimes say, when it very much isn't. One last passage, and the lesson will be yours. Revelation 3:16. You know this verse. You might be doing very, very well in a lot of ways. Maybe even spiritually, you're doing some things that are right. But if Satan, if he can keep you in that sin, if he can keep you doing something that'll keep you from God and convince you that you're fine and tell you that, get you to believe that there's an exception, right? It's just this one sin and it's hard, God will understand. However he gets you to justify that, to thinking it's going to be okay. It reminds me of Revelation 3:16, the Laodiceans. they were described as lukewarm. Right? Think about that. You're doing a lot well, and there's a lot that's right. There's just a little sin in there that kind of cools me off. And what is going to happen when I stand before God and I'm lukewarm? You know what happens. It's an awful picture. It's spewing him, spitting you out of his mouth. It's like the dog returning to his vomit. That's the picture of sin. It's all or nothing, right? We sometimes talk about almost. It doesn't count. Almost doesn't count unless you're playing, what, horseshoes and hand grenades, I think is the saying, the idiom, right? It almost doesn't count spiritually either. It's not horseshoes, it's not hand grenades by any means, right? You're going to be standing before God, and either you're right with him, and you did what he asked you to do, you were the servant he wanted you to be, or all is not going to be well. Don't use that phrase. Don't tell yourself that all is well when it's not. You say, preacher, that's mean. Well, listen to me. Let me explain why I say that. You heard a preacher say, and I've said it before, I don't want you to pillow your head tonight and be able to sleep if you're not right with God. Why? Because it's not, I'd rather you lose sleep over to make things right than to be comfortable in this world, than to be at peace in this world falsely and be lost in eternity forever. It's just not worth it. You and I both know that. There are lots of things we can learn about Gehazi. I hope that this brief illustration, story that God gives us, account, that we can learn some lessons from this, that we can not make the sacred things, the holy things, be just common, that we'll not think of ourselves as the center of the universe, that we'll put others first, and that we'll use that phrase right, that we'll really make sure that all is well. And so I leave it with you this morning. Have you become a Christian, a child of God? Because if you've never become a Christian, then all is not well. Maybe things are going well for you in this world, and that is great. That is wonderful. But if you're not right with God, all isn't well. You're no better off than Gehazi. Make that right, believing that Jesus is the Son of God, John 8:24. Repenting of sin, Acts 17:30. Confessing with your mouth that Jesus is the Son of God, Matthew 10:32. And to be buried in baptism, all of the sins remitted, forgiven, everything that you've done. I've got a lot of sin, preacher. That's all right. The power of Jesus will wash away every bit of that, but you've got to make the decision to obey it. Acts 2:38. Maybe you've done that, and you've let sin back into your life. If Satan has convinced you all is well, it's time to let go of that. If there's sin in your life, all is not well. You can make it well, though. You can leave here being well, being right with God. Confess that sin and repent of it before it's too late. If we can encourage you, if we can assist you, if you're subject to the invitation in any way, come forward, please, right now, as we stand and sing together.